KSDP, 830 AM in Sandpoint, K201DA, 88.1 FM in King Cove, KOLD, 91.9 FM in Cold Bay, KFPS, 88.1 FM in Falls Pass, and KKQA, 88.1 FM in Accutan, Alaska.
I'm a paleo nerd, don't you understand? I'm a paleo
nerd.
Hello!
Hey, Ray!
You're gonna let me do the Hey, Ray!
Alright, do it, good.
Hey, Ray!
Hey, good to see you, Dave. So what's the latest in paleo news, man?
Well, I get some news feeds in every morning when I'm drinking my coffee, and a new ichthyosaur was found in New Zealand. Now, of course, new, meaning they found it in 2016, and it took all this time to, you know, describe it and write the research paper.
Revealed it today, all right.
Yeah, it was found. It's a 90 million years old fossil, all right? 6 million years from the boundary where all ichthyosaurs worldwide died out.
So are we in the Cretaceous or the...
We're in the Cretaceous, right in the middle of the Cretaceous, okay? But what kind of blew me away is I thought that all marine reptiles died out during the K-P-G
event. No, they dwindled off.
End of the Cretaceous. Yeah. So the ichthyosaurs died out first, a full 30 million years before the asteroid hit in Mexico. Yeah. But the mosasaurs and plesiosaurs, they all stayed on till the Cretaceous event.
Right. And the theory, the general understanding is that maybe mosasaurs replaced the ichthyosaurs, but then, you know, I don't know.
As far as the niche was filled. The ecosystem.
Yeah. So.
Okay. Because what the event that removed the ichthyosaurs from our wonderful planet was an anoxic ocean event from volcanism. It turned the oceans devoid of oxygen, and warming temperature and volcanism caused the oceans to kill the bottom of the food structure, which were the little tiny little foraminifera.
Yeah, there you go. It wasn't the mosasaurs that replaced them. It was helped along by this event in the middle of the late Cretaceous.
Yeah, I tried to dive down and find out, was this anoxic ocean event was the cause, but I couldn't get a definitive answer. But why is this fossil special is because it shows that these ancient reptiles weren't all the same, because this was a new species discovered, but it supports the idea that ichthyosaurs were more diverse and more widespread and able to change and evolve over time than current research had realized. Hmm. So, and New Zealand is funny. You know, it's just two islands down there in the South Pacific. There's a lot of fossils from New Zealand. They've got some good Cretaceous stuff there. Mostly marine.
I didn't know that, but that's cool. But you were also excited, too, because it was just a lumpy-looking rock, right, to the average guy.
Yeah, that's the other thing. We'll have a picture on the website. The top part of the photo is this lumpy rock, and the bottom is the CT-scanned particles of bone, which looks like a bone explosion. Mm. Right? Nothing is articulated. But from these CT scans and the 3D modeling, the scientists were able to deduce exactly what species it was and the differences between known ichthyosaur species. But when I zoomed in on this image, Ray, it was a rock. I mean, I tried to find little bits that would, like if you're walking around trying, you know, you and I have fossicked for fossils many times. And a fossil, some of them are hard to see, but when you see a bone or in the rock or a shell in the rock, you go, hey, there's a bone in the rock, there's a shell. This looks like a rock, and whoever found this, they must have eagle eyes, or I don't know how this
happened. Well, you and I have stumbled around on Gravina Island over here looking for ichthyosaurs ourselves, if you remember that.
We didn't find
anything, because they're there if you've got the eye.
Every time I go for fossils, I keep seeing faces. What's that called? Pareidolia? What's it called?
You see things that aren't there.
I'm always seeing two eyes and a nose in tree leaves and everywhere.
Well, I see that in clouds. You know, I've looked at clouds from both sides now. But yeah, no, that's cool. But yeah, in other locations like the Hell Creek Formation, you're walking around in tan rock, tan matrix, and the bone is brown. Fairly easy to spot, right?
Well, when I was looking for Triceratops, that was white. The bone was literally white.
That's unusual.
Kind of a brownish red strata. When I was talking to Lee Hall this past weekend, he went to the Flaming Cliffs
in
the Gobi, where Roy Chapman Andrews found the first fossilized dinosaur eggs.
Yeah, wow.
And he said it's white bones sticking out of red sand.
Wow.
It's the most amazing contrast when you're fossicking for fossils.
Wow, very cool. Who's our guest today, Dave?
That's what I was going to say.
Well, actually, I brought this one to you, but via another person who said, Ray, you've got to check this woman out. She's doing amazing stuff. And actually, it was our buddy Kirk Johnson at the Smithsonian. You know, the man's got some chops himself. And he says...
Oh, he recommended Lindsay?
Yes.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, so it came right from the Smithsonian.
That's some,
Chutzpah.
That's some paleo cred.
Paleo cred. And he told me that you really got to check out Lindsay Nicole. She is a YouTuber, and she's a younger person, of course. You know, you and I are legitimately boomers.
Well, I'm closer to her than you are to
me. Yeah, right. Yeah, that's true. I'm much farther away. Not much more mature. But anyways.
You have one foot in the grave, Ray.
You know, I'm already looking around for a place to be a good fossil, you know?
Well, you know what I'll do is I'm going to turn on that horrible old modem sound. Remember when dial-up?
Oh, yeah. She's internet. Yeah, I remember that.
I'm going to turn it on right now because that's how long it takes to connect in 2024. And we're going to talk to... Lindsay Nicole.
Lindsay Nicole, all right. Hey, Dave, meet Lindsay Nicole, zoologist, science communicator, internet creator, TikTok quick hit educator, and YouTube star, and rock and roll musician as well, too. Hey. So anyways, great to meet you here, Lindsay, and meet my buddy here, Dave.
Hey, nice to meet both of you guys.
Well, I feel like I already know you. Ray, she's famous as hell.
Well, I was recommended that I check you out from the director of the Smithsonian Museum of Natural History. So, you know, you had some real credit coming in. Kirk said, check out Lindsay Nicole. She's a fabulous science communicator. She's got great energy. And I guess Kirk sent you one of our books.
Wow. Yes, he did. When. Yeah, Cruising the Fossil Coastline. Yeah. Back a couple of years ago. I am such a big fan of Kirk. He introduced me to your guys' podcast, and so I'm so happy to be here.
Ah.
Well, it's a mutual admiration society, guys.
Okay. We all like each other.
So, Lindsay, are you a paleo nerd?
I would say so, yeah. I would actually say I am a young, maybe a baby paleo nerd. I'm kind of new to the paleontology realm, and so it's really exciting. You know, I feel like I have so much to learn. I guess we all do, but yeah, it's a really exciting place to be, just knowing there's a lot more out there for me to come across.
Well, as I like to say, too, you can't really understand the present without understanding and knowing the past. And your origin story is, so you weren't born a paleo nerd. You weren't one of those dinosaur-loving kids then, were you?
No, I wasn't. I kind of got into paleontology passively through my zoology degree in college. I wanted to work with big cats, and I have some experience doing that, and in the process of the degree, I had to take some evolution classes, and I was like, oh my God, this is so cool.
This is getting serious.
Yeah. It was just so cool to learn about the mechanisms of how, you know, everything came to be on this planet. Once I took a paleontology class in my last year in college, I was hooked. I was completely hooked. Started learning about the history of life. The Great Dying, I think the Great Dying was the turning point for me.
Yeah. Everything died 252 million years ago.
The Permian-Triassic boundary.
Oh, yeah. But tell me, though, it was the big cats that got you to go to Oregon State University? So it was a high school cat thing?
You know, in high school and middle school, you have those weird obsessions that people think you're going to grow out of. Mine was lions. I loved lions. I fell asleep to videos of lions on YouTube. And I came across this video of this guy volunteering with lions in Africa. And it was coming up on my senior year. I had to figure out a senior project to do. My school required like a 3-week internship at the end of our senior year. And I was like, what if I went to Africa for my senior project? It got approved by my high school. My parents said, you can go if you can pay for it. So I got a job, and my dad ended up going with me because he didn't want me going alone. So that was really fun to have that experience with him. And I just completely fell in love. I was at the sanctuary that had lions. They had rescued some tigers in South Africa, a leopard, a couple cheetahs.
What?
Wow.
What's a tiger doing in South Africa? Yeah.
Obviously, shouldn't have been there.
Okay.
Well, obviously, it's a cat sanctuary. But,
yeah. All right.
So I think you would bring your dad because you could probably run faster than him.
Yeah.
That's the evolutionary success story.
What does one do at a big cat, emphasis on big cat sanctuary?
Wait, you didn't watch Tiger King during the pandemic, Ray? Come on.
No.
It was pretty explanatory.
Definitely not Tiger King stuff.
I know.
Just prepped their food, went around, fed them, cleans their enclosures. And since it was such a big piece of land and they had so much space to roam, it took a lot of time just to do that throughout the week. So that was pretty much it. But just being so close to these massive apex predators was incredible.
Right. Right.
And I definitely found my passion there. So I decided to go to Oregon State so I could do zoology. And while I was there, I ended up doing an internship at Cheetah Conservation Fund in Namibia, which just strengthened my passion. And then I ended up graduating in 2020. And so, you know, right when the...
Oh, well, there's a thing that happened then. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah,
exactly. Yeah. So none of the places that I wanted to work at were hiring anybody. Like, they just couldn't, even if they wanted to, because of the pandemic. So I started making videos on TikTok about what I learned in college, and I actually ended up enjoying it a lot more than I thought I would, just teaching people about... Well, I started off with, like, videos on reproductive selection. Those didn't necessarily do very well, but then I started getting into, like, mass extinctions, weird worms, and kind of weird stuff, and people really liked it, so I continued, and now we're here.
I'm listening to or watching one of the interviews with you, and you were teaching for a bit, and then you ended up quitting your date job, which was teaching. Were you teaching at a high school?
Yeah, so I was teaching at this private high school. It was a very interesting setup. It was like, so I would have a one-on-one student. So they had to have like most private high school.
That's real private.
Because they were like competitive dancers or, you know, trying to go pro with hockey or whatever. So they had to have very flexible schedules. And so it was cool to teach one student at a time, sometimes two students at a time. It got them really interested in, you know, what I was teaching them because I was really basing the curriculum on what they wanted to learn. And that ended up helping me with my videos. Hmm. I would, you know, tell them about a video that I was going to make that day. Usually when they were more excited about it, the video did really well.
Also, you kind of bouncing ideas off of them or getting feedback and seeing what
because if a ninth grader, if a ninth grader finds it interesting, then generally the video is going to do well.
So
when you started on TikTok in your first videos, how many views did you get or subscribers, and how long did it take to get up to, did you reach a million on TikTok?
Both.
Or was it
YouTube? Or you got like 2 million in each now.
Yeah, so TikTok was the first million. When I first started off, it was July of 2020. My videos were generally getting like 500 views. And then I made one video about tiny wild cats, like a little sand cat, a little rusty spotted cat. And that video went viral. It got, I think, like 400,000 views.
Wow.
And from then on, my videos were just doing really, really well. And it was kind of a game of just trying to figure out what people were interested in. I was more interested in like the mechanisms of evolution. People were more interested in, you know, what's that disgusting creature on my floor? You know, I would make a video answering the question.
Right.
And so it kind of led me down this path of talking about the most like disgusting creatures on the planet, deep sea animals, and you know, now I'm doing more paleontology stuff, which is a lot more up my alley. So I'm kind of just all over the place, I think, with just animals in general.
It kind of started with cat videos. This cat video was the big breakthrough. It was what's in the video? We can post a link to it, I guess, but what was in the video that was so cool?
So what's funny is I actually ended up taking it down because it was kind of like, oh, you've heard of big cats, but have you heard of tiny cats? These cats that are like, you know, 2 pounds, some of the smallest wild cats in the world. A lot of them are, you know, vulnerable to the illegal pet trade. And so I wasn't expecting the video to do well, but it did. And a lot of the comments were like, oh my God, I want this as a pet.
Where can I get it? Oh my God. So you actually opened up the interest in the species, which is exactly what we don't
exactly,
want.
Exactly, wow. Yeah. So I ended up taking
it down.
Good
on you for taking the video down. Yeah. Good on you for that.
I did that now.
So how long did it take to reach... Yeah. From 500 views to 1 million, was it in a year? Was it a few weeks? Because when a video goes viral, it can be instant.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. It took about a year to hit 1 million followers. And it feels like it happened so fast because at the same time, a few months into starting TikTok, I got an internship at the Wildcat Sanctuary in Minnesota. And so then I started balancing both. And so I was definitely more focused on the job that I had. But then once that internship was over, I, you know, got the job as a teacher. Right. I went back home and started teaching. And I really started putting a lot more effort into TikTok. And then probably about a year later, I think I spent a total of a year and a half, 2 years teaching. I got the opportunity to be in a TikTok commercial. Once that happened, I was like, you know what? I should just go for it. Try and do this full time. Start a YouTube channel. I did, and it ended up being the best decision I've made, and I'm able to, you know, work for myself now and just learn about new animals and make videos about them.
Well, you know, I love how you occasionally swear in your videos.
Now,
well, it gives it street cred.
Yeah.
Here at Paleo Nerds, we're G-rated because, the occasional swear word I get to bleep out.
Can talk every now and then. Whoa, I just tested
whoa,
it.
Whoa, whoa.
So what is your demographic, and have you had any pushback from swearing? I love it. I love the profanity in anything I see.
Yeah, thank you. I'm glad you like it. I would say my general demographic is like 18 to 35. I was hoping to be the channel that people can go to learn about prehistory and animals at a later age. I feel like there's a lot of channels geared towards kids, like teaching kids about dinosaurs or about these weird animals. And that's not necessarily captivating for, you know, teenagers or people in their 20s.
Right.
So
right.
I wanted to create this like casual kind of tone. So I don't censor myself at all.
Yeah.
And I try to speak like I'm just talking to a friend, and I think it's worked out.
I saw a video where you were saying, isn't it so cool that giraffes are alive? I mean, if someone were to describe this animal,
right.
But they really exist. So
yeah.
How cool is that? Be thankful that they exist.
Oh my God, yeah. I mean, everything. When you look at it in a prehistoric lens, if you learned about that animal that was, let's say, theoretically alive 3 million years ago, there's so many animals on our planet right now that we just take for granted.
Right. Ancient survivors. I've kind of stumbled into the world of science communication myself in a way. I was my art, you know, I was a paleo nerd kid, but as I dove deeper into my topics, you know, science began to really inform my stuff, and I began to do these kind of science education books and exhibits. And I remember a friend once saying that, you know, when you explain science to somebody, and this is for adults, you know, I said, it's like if you're trying to explain it to your bartender, talk like you're talking to your bartender, you know, and as you said, like
yeah.
As you're talking to a friend. But I'm just curious, your stuff is so compelling, so attention grabbing. There are a lot of lazy teachers out there, too, when we're talking your stuff is not PG 13. Are your YouTube videos being played in classrooms now? Do you know?
I have heard they are.
Lazy teacher.
Well, I've substitute teaching. You know, it's like, well, we'll just watch this today. So
we'll watch the video while I go online.
You really get a lot of information so quick. I mean, you're a quick hit educator, and you're attention grabbing. And I'm sure there must be teachers that maybe don't have your entertainment skills. They must be using you in classrooms, I would think, at least maybe in college classrooms.
Yeah, I know that some teachers are playing my videos in high school classrooms. I also got this message from this girl in a college class. I want to say it was like a science communication class, and the professor played my video and had all of them fact check me. And I thought that was so cool. And I was like, well, what were the results? She was like,
yeah,
you did a pretty good job. So I was very relieved to hear that.
Very well done.
But yeah, I think it's cool that my videos are being played in classrooms. I have definitely thought about making PG versions, like maybe a separate, you know, PG channel.
Well, you know, Allie Ward, you must listen to Allie Ward, Ologies, right?
Yes, I've heard of her, yeah.
Yeah, she's won, like, best science podcast. She's someone that I look up to. And she has something called Smologies, which is G-rated for the younger kids. So there definitely is a market out there. I think it'd be something to investigate, too. But
yeah, totally.
I like the swearing, so I'm not going to listen to it if you do it.
It's totally fair.
We're only...
Let me just say, you don't use a lot of swearing, so I don't want to put anybody off. It's, your stuff is fun, and it's the occasional here and there. And I want to ask one more question about your process before we get into some paleo stuff, which is really interesting. You found an editor in Argentina,
yeah.
Yes.
So is this someone you haven't met or you referred to? Tell us that story, because they kind of put your videos together in your style or their style, or is it a mix of both?
So his name's Gian, and I met him through my mutual, who is also a science communicator. His name's Milo. His YouTube channel is Mini Minuteman. He does archaeological content. He does debunking pseudoscience content. He is amazing science communicator. And we connected to do...
Where do you find him on social media? What's it called?
Mini Minuteman.
Mini Minuteman. I will have a link to that.
Yeah.
Okay, go ahead.
Yeah, he's awesome. So I did a collaboration with him right before I was starting YouTube. And I was like, you know, the editing process of YouTube is really intimidating to me. And he was like, oh, I have an editor. He's actually looking for more work. And so he got me in contact with Gian. And I have been with him since day one. He edited my first video. And he has edited every single one since. The style is his sense of humor. So it's very much a collaboration between the two of us, which I absolutely love. He's really funny. He puts great edits into it. And
he'll be on the screen sideways at some of them.
Yeah. Yeah, he's fantastic. And I actually ended up meeting him. He came to the United States over the summer. And we went on a trip fossil hunting together in Montana. It was awesome.
I was just in Montana. Where'd you go?
I was in Jordan. Right near the Hell Creek Formation. It's like 3 hours from Billings. I'm actually in Montana right now.
Oh, you are?
Yeah.
Where?
In Missoula.
Oh my goodness, I was in Bozeman 2 days ago.
Oh my God, that's so funny.
Are you at the University of Montana there?
I am doing some work with Complexly, which is Hank Green's company. They produce SciShow, PBS Eons. I did an episode of SciShow a couple months ago. I came up here and filmed it. I fell in love with Missoula. And they asked me up here again. And so I'm doing some more work with them. And I decided to spend a couple more days. So I'm staying here till Friday. It's so beautiful. I mean, I'm from, you know, I'm used to LA where it's just city. Yeah. So it's nice to get into the mountains for a little bit.
And you got some snow on Sunday, didn't you?
Yeah. There was some snow. It was beautiful flying in. Yeah.
I know. Yeah. Fantastic.
Well, you know, they've got all those Bear Gulch fossils there in Montana, in the University of Montana collection. So the Bear Gulch is a Carboniferous Age stuff and Mississippian Age and all these weirdo sharks. And I know you like weirdo sharks and ratfish.
Yes, I do.
Yes. And anyways, there's a great collection of fossils there should you want to go fossicking in the fossil collection.
Speaking of sharks and fish, what are you guys all yelling about whales or fish?
You want me to explain it to you?
Because in the email leading up to booking you on our show, Lindsay, I saw something about whales or fish. Yeah, I agree. Whales or fish. To the common person who doesn't really know that whales are not fish, they are fish. Do you want to just briefly explain it?
Yeah, totally.
They're mammals.
I'm happy to as well. Let's see what you got.
Okay. Yeah. Let's compare our explanations. So if you go back far enough in the fossil record taxonomically, all land vertebrates, all the tetrapods, evolved from lobe-finned fish. So technically, we are grouped under an umbrella of lobe-finned fish, which makes all tetrapods fish and all mammals fish. If you go back.
And reptiles and everything. Yeah. Yes.
And all reptiles, yes.
Yeah, you go back.
Birds. So we're all fish, Dave. So there, done. You did it beautifully.
I get that one, but to the person who fell asleep during science class, right, and someone says, oh, yeah, whales are fish. No, they're mammals.
Well,
because they have hair and they give milk to their young, so they have the traits. They're just four-legged creatures that went to they became marine mammals. So I don't want to confuse anybody.
Well,
or any kids running around, tell them that whales
well,
are fish.
It's a problem with the English, language and cladistics and all that, and things that, you know, you are related to the things you are from, right? So you're from
of
that
course.
Line, and that great line includes all those. But yeah, I read Moby Dick a few years ago, and, you know.
I read it this year, actually.
And there he's always talking about the great fish, and I'm always going, oh, he got it so wrong, but wait.
But they didn't know back then.
He got it right.
They didn't know when he...
You know, so.
Herman Melville wrote that. They didn't know.
Yeah, yeah. Anyways.
So, Lindsay, Ray, before every guest, he puts together this amazing list of questions. And not only does it allow me to see where our interview, the direction is going, but I get to do some homework and dive in. What is he talking about? But there's one thing on here I couldn't find any reference
what?
To. Ray, you wrote a question
Did
or a
I?
Statement... Tiktaalik is the reason we pay taxes. What does that mean?
I was watching an episode and we were talking about we're all fish. You use that line. I laughed out loud. Why Tiktaalik is the reason we pay taxes, right, Lindsay?
Yeah, I mean, you know, Tiktaalik is the reason we have hands. If you go back far enough.
Okay.
Now we pay taxes and we have society.
Yeah, we're all gonna die. Yeah.
That's a
Tiktaalik gave
stretch.
Us, I'd like to say Tiktaalik gave us cheeseburgers, you know?
Yeah.
Okay.
Glass
Get
half
it?
Full.
All right.
Yes.
Getting back to the questions that I prepare and all that, and Dave and I are 80 plus episodes into this. When the pandemic happened, this was a pandemic project for us.
A pandemic baby.
It was a pandemic baby, and it spawned this series. And at first, because we had a lot of time on our hands, we were doing a bunch of episodes and then realized, wow, as we kind of got back into our regular lives, how much work it is. And we slowed down to one episode a month now. You are cranking out. What's your schedule like? You're doing a massive project right now where you're explaining the entire history of Earth.
Yes.
In three, like, hour-long chunks? Is that what you're doing?
On YouTube, correct?
Yeah, on YouTube. So the episodes are about an hour long right now. I'm just finishing up the Neogene, so I'm almost finished. But, yeah, it's been a project that I've been working on since September of last year. Once I got to the Mesozoic, it started taking me a little bit longer than, you know, the other ones were taking me in the Paleozoic. But yeah, so right now I'm aiming to put out two videos a month. One is an episode of the history of life on Earth, which ends up being somewhere between 45 to probably 75 minutes long. And then a second video that I kind of do as like a, it's kind of like a in the works while I'm working on the big one video that's like.
So kind of behind the scenes type
well,
thing?
Well, it's like. Zombie infections is one that I just put out, like the cordyceps.
Yeah, I saw that one.
Yeah, so that one to me is a little bit easier to research than a history of life video. And so it's kind of like my break from the episodes.
Got
yeah.
it. And you referenced The Last of Us in the in the zombie.
Oh, yeah, I had to.
Yeah. What is that mold growing out of that zombie's
yeah.
head?
Well, but do you do daily TikToks in the meantime or Instagrams?
Yeah, so before I started YouTube, I was making a TikTok video every single day. And that was really hard to stay on top of because depending on what I was doing a video on, the research would be like an hour to 4 hours for a 30-second video. So when I started YouTube, I had to figure out how to balance that. And it was really hard at first because I was trying to keep up with one TikTok a day, one YouTube video every week. I realized very quickly that that was not going to be sustainable for me. And so as I started to get more into YouTube, I started to really like just kind of being in a hole for 2 weeks, no updates, and, you know, then finally coming out with this finished product. And so I haven't been making TikToks as much, but I've found that I kind of miss the creativity that came with making a video on TikTok
right.
every single day. I would just throw out ideas that didn't necessarily matter. Yeah. And so my goal for 2025 is to find a better balance. I think once this series is over and I'm going back to typical 20-minute videos 3 or 4 times a month, I think that'll give me some more time to kind of mess around.
What's the name of the long-form video? It's the history of the world?
History of life on Earth that we know of.
That we know of.
That we know of. Oh, that's yes. right. There's your fantastic catchphrase. That we know
have
of.
Have you yes. trademarked that?
I have. Oh, yeah.
So I can't use it. Oh, damn.
Really?
Nope.
Is it on your merch? Because you have a prolific merch page. I checked
yes.
out.
Yeah, it's on my merch. So I just finished a pre-sale that I was really excited about.
I know. It interrupted something I was doing, your pre-sale.
Yeah, I was really excited about it. I had this really cool, like, metal band style Great Dying t-shirt with all these facts about the Great Dying. I had a Spinosaurus hoodie, which I saw extremely
that.
Intimidated by Spinosaurus research, and I kind of made it a joke in, you know, the text included on that.
Did I spy a Helicoprion on that one too?
On the Great Dying Tea, yes. Oh yeah.
Oh,
Ray just sat up in his chair a bit.
I spent 20 years of my life working on that shark. That
yes.
ghost shark.
You made that illustration.
Yes. You know, I was going to say, hey, Lindsay, you should be using my art. And then I looked in and went, wait, she's using my art.
Oh, she already does.
It's all over the place. But I'm cool with that. But what do you do about actually, you know, because if it's out there in the internet, is it fair game? I mean, you don't do many.
Yeah, what's the legality of using artwork on a paid
Don't worry, my people
platform.
Aren't going to come talk. I'm glad my stuff is on. I'd love to see my stuff being used in educational, you know, for educational reasons. But you do grab film clips and things and art from everywhere in the web. What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, so it's actually something that I am currently figuring out, because I think the switch from TikTok to YouTube was an interesting one in that sense, because TikTok, I wasn't really making any money from those videos, and they're all educational, so then that comes with different guidelines and everything, since it's being used for educational content. And then when I collaborated with my editor, like, my editor is finding the pictures and everything. Now I'm getting to a point where I really have to organize and consider all of the guidelines that I need to be a lot more strict about. Like, in all honesty, was kind of just like, I'm just making these videos, like, I wasn't thinking about it.
Right.
And
right.
so, yeah, I'm putting a lot more time into figuring out what exactly those guidelines are now that the channel's bigger.
I'm asked quite a bit about using my art, and, you know, people will, they're nice enough to ask me, and I always say, thanks for asking and stuff, you know, and there it is. And so my Ages of Rock image, you know, the geologic ages.
The strata. The data in the strata.
Well, the data, but it's all the ages. I call it the Ages Rock instead of Rock of Ages. See what I'm doing there?
Okay.
Yeah, it's been used around the world, and every now and then I get asked, but there's just a point where, like, you know, it's basically free advertising and people are coming back to me, and I don't try to, you know, I just love to, my job is to create and try to keep, you know, control of things. But, well, now we have AI just sucking everything out of the world and throwing it on there. But these are interesting topics for our times. But I think what you are doing, though, is really a revolutionary approach to science education. I think it
Thank
is
you.
The wave of the future. And I think it's obvious from your, you've got people just watching and loving what you do. Do you actually get some haters or just pushback or people that start pitching you Shizola?
Yeah, I mean, being a woman on the internet will always come with some weird people, especially I've noticed that I am not appealing to a certain demographic of young men who do not want to listen to a woman telling them, you know, teaching them things. I also have gotten some pushback from people who don't believe in evolution, but luckily that's pretty much it. It could be a lot worse. So I'm definitely not complaining. And I know that my teaching style is not for everyone either, because I kind of talk aggressively in my videos, which I've found works for my audience, which is why I do it. But, you know, it's just not for everyone. So, yeah, that's pretty much the extent of it, which I am, you know, more than happy with.
But what is great is that you found a personality, you found a way of dealing out this fantastic paleo information to millions of people who wouldn't ordinarily have any clue what you were talking about, but you make it easy to understand and fun to watch, which is great.
Thank
Kudos
you.
To
I really appreciate that. Thank you.
As you dove deeper into paleo, and now you're explaining the entire history of life in like 3-4 hours, what are some of the, I mean, just randomly cool things in the last couple of years, factoids that just really got you going?
The Tully Monster.
The Tully Monster.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
Just rattle them off. Tully Monster. I dig it. Where do you stand on that? Is it?
By the way, you know, we create a page for every interviewee on Paleo Nerds, so there's going to be a Lindsay Nicole.
Oh, yeah. Awesome.
I'm going to have a link to Tully Monster.
Cool.
I just want to ask you, what is Tully Monster? Is it a vertebrate or is it an invertebrate?
I'm going to guess invertebrate. That's where I land right now.
Well, you know.
But didn't they do, wait, didn't Jasmine?
Yasmina Vyman chemically proved that it was, with the chemicals, that it was in the green lasers and stuff, that it was a vertebrate.
All right, I'll go with that.
Well, she says that. Well, anyways, that's one of the episodes. What about what was the appendage thing, like opabinia?
That's a snorkel.
No, opabinia. What's the phrase that you guys are talking about with appendages? And
a proboscis?
The proboscis?
Oh, it's a proboscis. Did I say proboscis? Is that a flower?
We do that all the time with Dave.
All right, so Tully Monster. Tully Monster,
what else you got?
The Cambrian period in general, everything from the Cambrian period just tripped me out.
I love how you coined the phrase. What'd you call it?
Nature's acid trip. Yeah.
Yes.
Hallucigenia.
Oh, yeah.
Hallucigenia.
Yeah.
Do you say anomalocaris or anomalocaris?
I said anomalocaris, and I didn't know if that was right or not.
What is it? How do you say anomalocaris? Did I do it right?
I think that's the accepted way. I say anomalocaris.
Anomalocaris. So anyway.
And you know what's crazy? When I was, how old are you?
I'm 27.
27. When 70. I was about 25, I was doing nightclubs and partying, and I was in the whole nightclub world of comedians and comedy clubs, and I was reading the It's a Wonderful Life.
Wonderful Life, not It's a Wonderful Life. It's a Wonderful Life is the movie.
Sorry, not the Jimmy Stewart movie.
Yeah.
I was reading Wonderful Life by Stephen Jay Gould.
I don't think I've read that.
It's all about the Cambrian.
Okay, cool.
And it's kind of like the textbook about the Cambrian.
Well, Stephen Jay Gould, so, in that book, it was a pretty revolutionary book. You should check that out because he's just about the Cambrian explosion and really about the Burgess Shale and all the weird creatures that didn't fit easily into known phyla, you know. And he insisted in that book, too, that if you were just to restart life again, we don't get here.
Yeah.
You know, it's just because there were animals.
That's a very scary, scary thought.
No, but we're predetermined to have this planet.
But you know what, though? With all the great dyings, with all the mass extinctions, we somehow are here.
Maybe if it happened again, then the dinosaurs would be the intelligent species.
Yeah. There are some books on that artist's conception of animals that became a technological society.
I'm honestly surprised that the arthropods didn't do it.
Well, I think they'll get there someday.
We'll be long gone.
They'll certainly outlive us.
Yeah, long gone, you know, but I like this litany of cool factoids. So we have just the Cambrian, Tully Monster.
Calicotheres.
Calicotheres. You say calicotheres, I say calicotheres.
I just read it and I guess.
Kirk Johnson and I are working on a book right now, a fossil atlas book, and I was just drawing some calicotheres, and I was drawing them out, and on the map I called them gorilla horses.
Yeah.
Which is a new phrase. And he said, troll, what is this gorilla horse thing? That doesn't make sense. So, well, no, they're being called gorilla horses. I said, why? Well,
describe it.
Well, he says they don't have claws. And I said, well, they're gorilla horses with claws then, you know?
Yeah.
Well, actually, tell Dave what a calicothere is and the audience.
Yeah, so there are these group of mammals that first evolved in the Paleogene. I want to say in the Eocene that...
Around there.
They look like a horse started walking like a gorilla. So their back slopes downwards, but they have a very horse-like, or I guess maybe just a general ungulate face. Pretty horsey face. And they seem to have, you know, reached into higher branches and grabbed leaves from, you know, upper.
They weren't bipedal, though.
No.
But they were able to go on their hind limbs.
Wow. We're going to have some pictures of calicotheres. How do you spell them?
C-H-A-L, calicotheres.
Oh, there is a CH in there.
But what's cool about them, too, is, and like Lindsay was saying, they kind of, obviously sat down in their haunches when you look at them. So it just parked by a tree and start pulling stuff in. But those big claws could also be used, you know, to ward off predators, because I'm sure they were easy snacking, you know. So
totally.
Come look at theirs. That's cool. So
that's pretty cool.
Ratfish caught your eye, though, too, at some point?
Well, I just love the word rat. I think anything... Oh, hell yeah.
Ray is pulling back his... got to get in the camera there, Ray. Stand up.
Stand up, Dave.
He's actually showing some very white, pallid skin.
And I have a flaming trilobite over here. But
yeah.
Oh, hell yeah.
Let me see. Let me do a picture of that, Ray.
Of the... Let me, all right.
There we go. Perfect.
That's awesome.
I have a very long history with ratfish. I just became obsessed with them when I first moved to Alaska. Caught one, blew my mind. They look like an alien creature, and I was right, because basically their body form was, you know, established back in the Paleozoic. So it is really like looking at a creature from another world, the previous worlds.
Totally.
And the big eyes and stuff. But yeah, ratfish, I loved them from the start because it sounds like rat fink, anything ratty, which rat fink is something I grew up with, you know, way back in the day. I became so obsessed with them, though, that I reached out. This was a turning point in my career, too. I like to think that I started hanging out with scientists, and I said, well, who do I talk to? I want to know more about ratfish. And they said, well, call up this woman. She's a specialist, Dominique Didier. She's in Philadelphia teaching at the Academy of Natural Sciences.
One of our previous guests.
One of our earliest guests. I just called her up and said, hey, I dig ratfish. Can you talk to me about ratfish? I learned so much from about them. And after I started drawing them, my band is named the Ratfish Wranglers. I have a tattoo of ratfish. Started wearing ratfish on my head. It's kind of crazy. But it was just this underappreciated, much maligned fish. Like, ooh, what the hell is this? That I just fell in love with, and it taught me so much.
Super successful.
And then one day, Dominique called me up and said, I'm going to name a species for you. So, Hydrolagus trolli. So, it is the troll's pointy-nosed blue chimera.
Wow.
So, that's so awesome.
Yeah.
Congratulations. So that's so sick.
Yeah. Congrats, Ray.
Poor thing has got my name forever.
Another thing that you're interested in, I can't remember, Ray, maybe you'll remind me who said this quote, God had an inordinate fondness for beetles.
It was Stephen Jay Gould. No, E.O. Wilson. E.O. Wilson.
Was that who said that?
Oops. Actually, it was J.B.S. Haldane, the renowned Oxford scientist who introduced the primordial soup origin of life theories. He advanced the fields of genetics, made significant contributions to evolutionary biology, and made that famous quote about beetles because beetles are the most diverse group of organisms on Earth, with upwards of 350,000 known species, accounting for about 25% of all animal species. That's mind-blowing. That's one out of every four species is a beetle, man. And no, I'm not talking about the Fab Four from Liverpool. We're talking about insects here. Man.
There are more species of beetles than anything else on this planet. Is that correct?
Yeah.
Well, except for archaea, except for all the little tiny bacteriums and all that stuff.
Yeah, definitely of all other animals. Yeah, there's like over 350,000 species that have been described. So then how many more are there to find, you know?
Yeah.
There's so many beetles. It's crazy.
Well, I once heard a quote saying, to the first calculation, earthlings are insects.
Yeah.
Oh, there you go.
Yeah, to the first calculation.
There you go. That's cool.
Insects. And the most prominent vertebrate on the planet, the most numerous vertebrate on the planet, is actually a little fish, a bristlemouth in the Mesopelagic. They're little guys. And that was from a previous guest, too. We were talking about that.
Wow.
So it's planet bristlemouth.
Is that from Kelly Benoit Bird and the Great Migration?
Yeah.
Oh, they're part of the sunset and sunrise ocean migration from light to dark.
That was that interview with her. So I learned so much, too, on the show. But actually, I don't know, just to geek out for a minute, segueing back to cats. I know we've been rambling on here for a bit, but I was recently...
What do you have there?
Well, you know what this is.
Oh, my God.
Oh, yeah. That's a saber from a saber tooth.
Yeah, Smilodon.
Yeah.
So, but I was just out in Nebraska. This is actually just a plastic replica, but it's got serrated teeth on it, where I saw the type specimen of Barbarophilus, which was a Nimravid cat
from
Nebraska. And then I saw this extraordinary fossil. I just couldn't believe my eyes when I saw it. I got to actually hold it in my hands, but it's a Nimravus. That's the genus name. That had.
Okay, wait. For our listeners, tell everybody what a Nimravid is, because it's a term that I had to look up while researching for your episode.
It's a false saber tooth. It's not a true cat. It's an early group.
But it's a giant cat. I mean, you wouldn't want to meet this.
So it's basically
a cut on your hand.
It's a saber tooth cat-like.
Right.
Like. So it's like there's these early starts and there's this lineage that has pretty much the same forms, but they're not true cats. But I saw this Nimravus fossil that had bitten clean through another Nimravid cat right through the leg bone. And it died. It died with its saber all the way through the other cat's leg. And clean right through, you could hold it both sides. And so this was a Thursday afternoon where these two saber cats, false saber cats, died. One of them died. Well, they both died because it just got stuck. And I just couldn't believe how that blade, this thin blade, could go right through a humerus like that.
That's insane. And then to get stuck.
It is insane. And then to get stuck. And then it died.
That's just crazy. I've seen the deer walking around with another deer's head on the antlers.
Well, and there's other skulls that they have in the collection out there in Nebraska where there's like another saber puncture in another cat's skull. Like, you know, so
that is insane.
And how do you think, I mean, you've just been finishing up these long videos and you're into big cats. How do you think saber cats did their thing and taken down prey?
I don't know. I mean, I have a hard time imagining it because I feel like they would just get in the way, you know?
Yeah.
Like, it doesn't make any sense to me. I have a hard time imagining that, like, them being that bulky could actually be very efficient to deliver a fatal blow, I guess.
Yeah, there was a paper recently saying that they were for display only, that more often than not, they would break off, and what would they do? They would stab and wait for the animal to bleed out. But you have evidence. You saw evidence of a blade going through a bone.
I'll send you guys pictures of it, and
yeah,
it's been looked
at.
Yeah,
there goes that theory.
Actually, upon further research, it turns out that extreme saber-tooth forms and sizes, those knife blade stabbers on a lion's head, evolved repeatedly due to functional optimization for puncture performance. Despite increased fragility, it highlighted a trade-off that drove specialization and contributed to extinction vulnerability. So it sounds like the trade-off between breaking their teeth and being able to puncture into a leg bone actually didn't help with their continued survival. The link to that paper is in Lindsay's Paleonerds episode page. Let's get back to that discussion.
The internet has taught me many things, and actually social media and stuff, and there is Nature is Metal on Instagram. I cannot look away when I see these. Those are not Walt Disney films, so kids, if you're going to, don't look at it. But
yeah.
I remember there was one they recently posted. It's a tiger that has just gripped, you know, the throat of a cattle in India, and it's...
A cattle. A cow.
But it's just standing there. The cow is standing there. The tiger is standing there. And it's just got it there. It's put, and it's just, they're both standing. And that made me think, oh, I wonder if that's how saber-toothed cats just went for the throat, latched on, and just held, you know, until the animal just waited.
And just waited.
Suffocation is the way that a lot of lions actually take down.
Yeah. I think if we look at extant cats now, Siberian tigers, and cheetahs, and lions, and infer the past from the present.
I would think so, but, you know, there's an interesting theory, too, and I know maybe I'm babbling on too much here, but I was talking about the book The Tiger, and that's a book about a Siberian tiger.
The Tiger by John
Valiant. And I got to meet John. He's a brilliant writer. It's one of the most compelling.
Have you heard about this book?
A compelling book.
True story about a tiger in the...
Taiga.
The taiga in Russia, eastern Siberia, going on a killing spree and killing people on purpose.
With intent.
Wow. It
hunted them down in particular. But one of the things that Valiant talks about in that book is the idea that big cats actually helped to drive human evolution and primate evolution, because we were the prey on the, you know, in the fields of Africa.
Dinner's ready.
We were apes up in the trees that began to, because of the pressure that big cats put on us as prey, and us maybe also sneaking up and getting their...
So we had to be more aware.
We had to be much more aware of having to deal with
this. I don't
know.
I think anything that was their food would have to be more aware.
But we're the ones that started figuring out how to deal with them. You know, I don't know if you've ever heard that one at all.
I haven't heard that, but that makes sense to me. I mean, cats were the apex predators throughout the entire history of humans. So,
and now we have them as house pets. So,
So we really showed them.
Lindsay, would you be called an influencer or just a or an educator?
I guess some people would call me an influencer, but I call myself a science communicator.
Okay.
Yeah.
I like that better.
Yeah, me too.
I'm not going to buy whatever shampoo you say works great in your hair.
Right.
Well, being an influencer and knowing that your audience is, you know, younger people, what do you think about things like bans on kids under 16 in social media?
Australia's only one country. Australia has banned social media for children under 16. However, it's not enforceable, and there aren't any social media police. So, Jimmy, you may not be on social media at age 15 and a half.
Yeah, I don't know how they could possibly enforce that.
They can't. They can't.
But
that's what they said. There's no way to enforce it. But it does set a precedent saying that social media is harmful to children.
Totally. And I think, like, I grew up when social media was becoming social media, and I was lucky enough to just not be interested in certain things that people in my class were looking at online. But I know that there were certain things that were coming up that were just completely traumatizing. And that was when it was, you know, kind of earlier in the internet days. So I can't imagine what that looks like now for kids in high school and middle school who are hearing about these things that people are seeing online and want to see them themselves. And, you know, while the internet can provide so many amazing tools for learning for kids that just makes more sense for them, there's also the bad side of the internet that just can't be ignored, I guess. So I understand the desire the desire to ban, not, I guess, you know, restrict internet access for kids, because I know what it did to people who
are
my age now.
You know?
Yeah.
Yeah.
My son, who's 22, just in hanging out on paleo digs, we just talking on long car rides, he told me when he was 12 and 13, he saw every horrible thing on the internet. You know, I'm not going to even mention it, but, you know, war stuff and accidents and all that type of thing. And sadly, that's something that my generation, I never saw when I was a kid.
Totally. Yeah.
So,
and humans just weren't meant to see all of those horrible things so much.
Yeah.
And that's definitely having an impact on mental health.
I don't know about that. You know, let's go back 400 years when most births ended in the death of the baby and the mother.
That's true.
People generally used the outside of their house as the sewer. So plagues were rampant, where in the 1300s, you know, you'd have an entire town erupt in pustules and boils in front of your face. So maybe, I think if we can avoid seeing it, we should.
Yeah,
Dave and I talk a lot about social media, and of course, we get our show out there via the podcast, and we have, you know, a social media manager, Ashley Hall, who helps us out, get the stuff out there, but... Hi, Ashley.
Hi, Ashley.
You really are at the beginning of a new science communication technique, really, a new approach to science education. And maybe this borders on what Dave is going to ask here in a minute. But hey, Lindsay.
Yes.
If you could go back in time, what exciting epoch, what perfect period, what exquisite era would you want to go back to, and what precisely would you want to see?
That's so hard. I feel like I would want to be somewhere near the beginning of the Cambrian explosion, but I would also want to be a lot smaller than I am.
Okay.
I would want to be like a centimeter in length so that everything was much bigger.
And but you'd be the victim. You'd be prey.
I guess so.
You'd be eaten.
But then, you know, Anomala Charis would look like a whale, and that sounds really cool.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So that's cool. Yeah, because everything in the Cambrian Ocean was pretty much just a couple inches or even less, maybe a half an inch, and then there was Anomala Charis. So, but yeah.
Yeah. And then I watched one of your videos where you kept saying epic.
Yeah.
Epic.
You could say.
So is it epic or epoch? What is it?
It actually is both ways, Dave. We established this early on. So if you want to sound highfalutin, you say epoch. And then if you're American, you say epic.
Is that the English?
I don't know what it is. It's epoch.
Yeah. Epoch is the British pronunciation.
Yes.
Yes.
And epic is the American. And to me, that makes sense, you know?
Yeah. Aluminum and aluminium.
Yeah.
Controversy and controversy. Yes, and all that.
Yeah, controversy. Yeah, that's great. The Cambrian is awesome. And I'm going to ask something I've been thinking about. I love your influencer demeanor and attitude. You know, Ray says that you are breaking grounds, but I think that you're just different. You're different, you're fun to watch, and you're personable, and you are engaging. You're engaging, it looks like, without any effort, which is awesome. And
I'm glad it comes off that way.
yeah, you're awesome, and I'm a fan.
Thank you.
My question is that you're dedicated to sharing accurate information on social media. You do all this exhaustive research, which is awesome, and you were fact-checked. It proves you're doing the homework. How do you navigate a space where misinformation and sensationalized content are so prevalent? And what advice would you give to other creators who want to prioritize authenticity and education over the constant desire to go viral and make bank?
I think if you are getting into content creation for the desire to go viral, then that is going to be an issue already. If you're dedicated to going in and, you know, delivering accurate scientific information, I would say the best way to go about it, especially when it comes to debunking misinformation and pseudoscience and all that, is to debunk it. My approach is debunking it passively, correcting things passively, because we are so divided in so many different ways across the internet and just where we are, you know, in the world. And I think when you approach someone with this attitude, like, I know more than you, you're wrong and you're stupid, they're never going to hear you. And if that's your approach to your content, all of your audience is going to be people who already agree with you, not people who disagree with you and might be interested in learning something new or, you know, learning that this idea that they've had is wrong. So I think that's the best way to go about going against misinformation, is just being a person and allowing people to be wrong without making them feel bad about it. Yeah, I mean, I experienced that in my own career, I guess. When I first started, you know, wanting to work with big cats, I had this idea of petting lions and, you know, like walking alongside them and all of that. And that is actually what fueled my desire to go to college. I wanted to, like, be with the lions and all that. But then I worked at the Cheetah Conservation Fund, and passively my supervisor was explaining, you know, why would we interact with them if it doesn't benefit them at all, and kind of just talk to me like a person about it. And it took really no effort for me to switch my mind and change my mind about it. And now I am very much actively against people interacting with predators.
Well, you might get bit.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, you can get really hurt and they can get really hurt, yeah. And there's really just no benefit. And
there's no benefit.
And I don't think that I would have learned that lesson if someone approached me like I know more than you, you're stupid and you're wrong. Right. I think I would have become more defensive. And so I really try and bring that method into my content as much as I can.
Well, I think what you really do is it's your excitement and your passion is genuine and it's fun. And it could, you could tell it's just legitimate and you're not confrontational. You're just excited about the material and that's what's there. And that's your own way of helping to change and shape the world. And I think science communication is more important now than ever. And as